This is Comic Geek Speak, episode 327, a conversation with Gerard Way, author of The Umbrella Academy. And welcome to Comic Geek Speak. I'm Peter Rios, and I will be your only geek for today. We have the opportunity to talk with Gerard Way, author of The Umbrella Academy from Dark Horse Comics. Special thank you to Dark Horse Comics for setting this up. The interview has already been recorded, so I just want to let you know that what you'll hear first is an interview with Gerard Way, where we talk about Umbrella Academy and comics and, you know, just a bunch of other stuff. There might be a few spoilers in that interview episode, not many. Nothing major that'll, you know, that will, interrupt your enjoyment of the book itself. But then following the interview will be a discussion, a little bit more in-depth discussion of Umbrella Academy with, Dr. Jeff Klock, who we just had on recently, where we get a little bit more into some of the themes and some of the characters and plot points and things like that. So the first half in the interview, you know, feel free to take a listen to, especially if you haven't read the book yet, I think you'll learn some things about the inspirations and Gerard Way's thoughts behind The Umbrella Academy. And then the second half of this episode is probably for people who've read it. So you'll hear a clear defining point in the middle of the episode where you can just stop, and there isn't really anything after my conversation with Jeff Klock. So some websites, of course, jeffklock.blogspot.com. You can also go to darkhorse.com, and at Dark Horse you can find a link to the Umbrella Academy itself under their comics sections. And Umbrella Academy, The Apocalypse Suite, is written by Gerard Way, artist Gabriel Ba, cover artist James Jean, colorist Dave Stewart, and the letter of at least the Free Comic Book Day issue was Nate Picos. So it is a fun read, it's a fun interview, and I think you'll enjoy it. So take a listen and enjoy Gerard Way of The Umbrella Academy. Okay, and on the phone we have Gerard Way, and he is the mastermind behind Dark Horse's The Umbrella Academy. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, by the way.
No problem. Actually, this has been really great because there's been some talk on our show about The Umbrella Academy recently.
Cool.
One of the first things I think we need to let listeners know that they probably don't know is that you actually went to school with aspirations to become a comic book artist. And
I went to School of Visual Arts in New York City. I graduated, and my major was cartooning. So I had a lot of really amazing teachers like Sal Amendola, Joe Orlando before he had passed away.
Oh, nice.
I had Carmine Infantino, Klaus Janson, Joey Cavalieri. I had some, you know, a Dame Darcy. Like, so I had like the full run of completely different comic book artists. And that was my major. That was really what my line of work was going to be.
Yeah. So it was in your blood. I mean, not only were you out of school for the arts, but I mean, you also were a fan of comics as well. So this has been
right
in your blood for a long time.
A long time. Yeah. Comics were really like, I didn't grow up in like the safest of areas. So comics were like really the best escape. Cause it actually allowed my head to swim a lot more than let's say watching a movie. When you're watching a movie, your brain kind of shuts off.
Right. Right.
You're reading a comic, there's just so many open possibilities. Like, it's almost more, a comic book to me is more about what you don't see in the comic, and what you're thinking about. Like, I was a huge X-Men fan, and I, like, you know, probably end up thinking more about, like, what Wolverine was doing when he wasn't on panel. And then even when I was waiting for the next issue, I was always wondering what's going to happen. And TV
right
and movies, not necessarily like that all the time.
I read an interview, you had a funny comment where you said one of your first comics was an X-Men comic with Wolverine on the cover, and the thought that went through your head was, yeah, this will piss off the parents.
Completely, yeah. Which actually didn't, but like being raised Catholic, that was kind of obvious. That means I'm not a Catholic anymore, but being raised Catholic, you're kind of like, you know, seeing that image was just like, oh man, this is totally wrong.
Right.
I totally get that this is wrong, and I totally get that this is going to bum people out. It was a really powerful image, and I think it was for a lot of readers at the time. Yeah, but I definitely brought that home in hopes to aggravate them. And I did a lot of things that tried to aggravate them back then, but it never really registered.
What's kind of interesting, though, is that, you know, here now you're writing a book, The Umbrella Academy, and family is such a strong theme running through these issues that I've read so far. And it was interesting to hear your comment of that back then, and then to read some of the characters like Kraken especially, and even Vanya, who are sort of like the outcasts in this family that has been created. So family seems to be a strong thing that you're trying to, you know, mess around with.
It is, you know, because I mean that was actually, you know, one of the things I liked. One of the things I always felt was kind of, in a way, missing from the X-Men is that they weren't a family. I did like the fact that you'd have, like, you know, 16-year-old Kitty Pryde hanging out with, like, Wolverine, who was, like, total, like, bar-fighting weirdo wanderer. I always thought that was kind of really interesting and funny.
Right.
But, you know, there was no element of family, you know, and it was very important for me to have all these characters be adopted and be forced to really be brothers and sisters, even though they weren't. And in some weird way, since they were all born in the same exact second, they are kind of brothers and sisters.
Right.
And they are kind of related. Family, yeah, became really important to me because I found that being in a band and being on the road was very much like a family with its own set of function and dysfunction, and very interestingly so, because you're faced with a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. There's a lot of expectation. There's a lot of moments that you almost feel heroic, and then there's moments where you feel the opposite of that, and then there's moments of success. There's moments of failure. So being part of something that ended up being so big and cherished by a lot of people and misunderstood by so many people, it was very easy for me to kind of relate to a family of people with extraordinary abilities.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, someone picking this book up, they're going to see, you know, a giant monkey with a human head, and they're going to see a little 6-year-old running around with adults and a talking monkey. But as I read it, I mean, I'm currently, not to get personal, but I'm in a feud with my own older sister at the moment. And there's a heaviness going on, you know, with these characters, and what could seem at first to be sort of silly adventure fun, actually it has a story that I think we can all relate to.
Right, it does. And it does. I did try to make the comic have a lot of sincerity and a lot of heart. You know, it's really not a superhero comic. That was the goal from the get-go, though. It was to you know, in reading Doom Patrol by Grant Morrison, who was my idol and like my mentor in a lot of ways, and
awesome,
and in a lot of ways kind of like my big brother. You know, reading the Doom Patrol, I never felt like you had a robot hanging out with a weird negative space energy hermaphrodite hanging out with, you know, just the strangest characters.
Yeah.
I never felt like I was reading a superhero comic. I felt like I was reading a comic about people with a lot of problems. And that was definitely the goal from the get-go with Umbrella Academy, is just not feel like a superhero adventure. And it is heavy. Like, family's heavy. And family knows exactly how to hurt each other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, that's the big thing. Like, they know what gets each other. They know what the fears are that they possess. They know what's really going to bum them out. And you see more of that as the series goes on, especially between Space and Kraken. And they know exactly what to say to each other.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned Morrison, and I read that is your favorite writer. He is definitely high on my list as well. The man just has creativity just coming out of every orifice, it seems like.
Right, and that's really, in kind of being inspired by him, it's what takes so long to write each issue of the Umbrella Academy, because I'm not going to name names. You take an average superhero comic, right,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It's very like, okay, so-and-so hangs out with his relative, bad guy shows up, they fight, something happens to his wife, you know what I mean?
Like, right, right.
It's really like, this is what happens. Like, you read a Grant comic, every single page has an idea that could be its own comic thrown away in about 5 seconds.
Right.
You know, and to get that kind of density in there is really tough. Like, I'd say it takes me twice as long to do a page. I mean, probably because I'm slightly inexperienced as well, but twice as long just to cram a page full of ideas.
Yeah, and you know what, though? It's funny. Comics, like from Grant Morrison or Matt Fraction or the Umbrella Academy, I mean, really, they're just reflections of what we see on TV. How much info dump do we get on TV nowadays?
Right.
And you have to be receptive to all that information that's coming at you.
Right.
You know, quick hits from VH1 or CNN or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Also, speaking of family, your creative team, my God, Gabriel Ba, James Jean, Dave Stewart, that is
right.
Just, wow, you were blessed.
Yeah,
with...
I mean, I'm really lucky, you know, because especially, I'm sure they were all slightly skeptical going into this, of like, wait, you know, this guy's in a rock band.
Right.
How do we know we're even going to see a script? And when we see a script, how do we know it's going to be any good? It's just going to be, you know, it's just going to be self-indulgent and nonsense and... a lot of what he does with his band and is promoting his band, you know, like there's a healthy dose of skepticism, even from starting it with a creative team.
Mm-hmm.
But they all just really took a leap of faith and they all really believe in it. And that's actually what's the coolest part. Like when I work with Gabrielle, he works harder than me in some ways, you know, like just busting his ass to get the deadlines, because of like slight and occasional lateness, you know, on
right.
my part. And, you know, Dave, truly, truly, he's one of the most sought-after colorists in the industry, truly loves this book so much that he's, you know, quit some bigger books and kept this one. But he just loves it. So I'm really lucky to have all of them.
That's great. Do you read, do you try to keep up on current comics now?
Sometimes, you know, I usually just kind of pick up what looks interesting, like, or if a certain kind of art appeals to me. Like, obviously, I read The Goon, I read Hellboy, but I like stuff like Craig Thompson's Blankets.
Cool.
Anything like that where it's just like, oh, this is just gorgeous, you know? And well, the storytelling's so amazing. And I love Dave Lapham. I love Stray Bullets.
One of the reason why I brought that up is sort of connected to what you just said. There's been an influx of novelists and TV writers, and there has been the problem of delays. And
right.
you know, that... you know, you're getting your issues out, and I think that's a credit to you know... the approach that you want to bring to all this.
Well, it's definitely, yeah. I mean, well, it's a big credit to Scott Alley, the editor. He really works in a ton of time ahead of time. There's certain things he absolutely won't even go ahead on unless he's got certain things in front of him. And he's very good about getting me to meet my deadlines. We also ended up becoming really good friends over it and very close. And we have a great relationship. And it's, you know, we work together like buddies. And we're on the phone when I'm in the States almost every other day.
Wow.
So, yeah, and that's great. And I'm always just calling him up sometimes 3 a.m. my time saying, like, oh, I got this crazy idea for something in Series 4 that we should do. And he's like, cool, let's set it up now. And we just love talking about it together. I mean, you know, I would go to Portland, spend a week in a hotel. We'd be up every night till 4 a.m. talking about everything from Bob Dylan to, you know, just the X-Men to anything, you know. And it's really awesome. But, yeah, there has been, a lot of lateness, but... with that kind of thing. And I think that is really what's going to make a lot of books suffer. And, like, we need to roll right into Series 2. Oh, they're making an announcement. I'm at an arena in Sheffield, England.
Oh, cool.
And a lot of these arenas, they have these programmed announcements that run about every 15 to 20 minutes
yeah.
before the show starts, and they're really loud and annoying.
You said Series 4.
Right.
So how long are you planning this for?
I honestly, the way it is now, I see realistically, and this is, mind you, if I had to say series that really advance the overall plot forward,
right.
There's already 6 of those, but then there's always, you know, the thing about this comic is there's opportunities to do really fun ones too that don't necessarily move the plot forward.
Right.
They just want to riff on something and you just want to really tell a good story. So in that regard, I think I can do 8 series total, maybe 9, and that's about, you know, 10, 12 years of work right there.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about it in that regard. It's definitely my baby and Gabrielle's as well, and I really think he'll be doing the whole series till it's done, you know.
You say it's your baby, and just like the Monocle or fathers in general or parents in general, you have to have a favorite child. So which one of those characters is do you find fun to write?
It changes a lot. You know, I'm definitely going to say in starting the series, I thought I was going to end up using the seance a lot more than I have, but now, having gotten a little halfway through the series, I've really seen what his strengths are, and I'm really excited about using that character a lot more. Honestly, I think the rumor, though, is the most interesting, the most complex, and at the same time, the most normal because of those complexities. You know, she's somebody that has, you know, lived in the public eye, had her life fall apart multiple times. She's
right.
been through multiple divorces. She's had a lot of relationships fall apart because what she does. Yet at the same time, kind of likes it and likes the attention. And she's just extremely complex. And her power is really strange. The fact that she's able to lie and make it come true
mm-hmm.
has almost forced her to grow up as a liar.
And so
I think she's probably my favorite. I mean, it's tough. Like, Kraken is always a great time. I mean, that dude is like, you know, you just throw him through a plate glass window all the time. Like, it's just fun. And he writes himself with his dialogue.
Right.
He's just so salty. But I'd say, you know, the rumor, probably.
I was going to say that I saw one or two posts on various message boards or whatever where people would sort of assume that Seance was sort of your flesh suit, your fiction suit, as Morrison called it. I don't know what you think about that.
I don't know. Maybe because he delivers the line, "Everything I own is black," in issue two, and everything I own is black. So
right.
He's easy to write in that regard because he does have such a morbid tendency, and I do as well in a comical way. Like, he has a sense of black humor. I have a sense of black humor. So that kind of fits me in a little bit of way. And, you know, that is a character that does occasionally dabble in stuff like drugs, and that was a battle that I had in my past and stuff like that. So he's
right.
definitely a little bit self-destructive of a character.
Let's talk about Dark Horse. What how did this all come about, getting in touch with Dark Horse? Because this is between this and Buffy, this is a coup for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes, you know, I knew that I could go to comics and I could bring with me an audience. Not for my own benefit, but for the benefit of the medium.
Absolutely.
The industry. And I think comics, not, you know, I remember when I was trying to break into comics, man, we're talking about a suffering industry.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It was real bad. And that's in a lot of ways, I think it's why a lot of artists could not break in. I couldn't break in. It was tough. And I had this almost very borderline European style, which an editor would take a chance on nowadays, but wouldn't back then.
Right.
You know, I always think comics just deserves attention because a lot of these guys, like Joss Whedon, who's an amazing writer, grew up with this love of comics, and it influenced what they did when they grew up, you know. And so I always feel it's like you give back or you go back to the industry that inspired you originally. And so that was the initial thought to go to Dark Horse because I saw them as the coolest indie because they weren't afraid. They weren't snobbish. They weren't elitist. They weren't afraid to do things like superhero books or Hellboy or The Mask or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
That was very important to me. I wasn't going to go to a company that's like, oh, we only do autobio.
Right.
Like weird spoof comics of superhero stuff.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I didn't want to make a spoof at all. So, and I read mostly Dark Horse books. So, you know, they were an easy choice, but then getting the foot in the door, like my friend Jim Kruger, who writes Foot Soldiers for Dark Horse, Earth X with Alex Ross.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a longtime friend of mine, and he's a longtime friend of mine, and he was able, like, you know, when I said I have this series, he goes, well, who do you want? I said, I think Dark Horse would be great. And he says, well, I'll put you in touch with Eric Weiler, who's Mike Richardson's assistant. I did an official pitch, like a real pitch.
Wow.
Yeah, and with artwork, that it took me about 2-3 months to get that artwork really hammered in and the pacing of the pitch and yet make it simple. It took me more time to cut stuff out of the pitch and just make it really crystal clear. And so I had sent that to Eric, and he loved it. And then, you know, he thought the perfect editor would be Scott Alleyford, who does Buffy and he does Hellboy. He was right. You know, it was a perfect fit. Like, Scott saw it. He was initially very skeptical, and then he saw the pitch. He says, well, I need this book. Like, I want to do this book.
Awesome.
So, yeah, it was pretty great.
We've been talking to a couple retailers here and there, and we bring up a number of, you know, of the books that are crossing different lines, like Dark Tower and Buffy and Umbrella Academy, and they all say the same thing. the promotional Free Comic Book Day thing was such a smart idea to launch this series out of that. And they say they get people in that usually never get into comic stores to pick asking for this book.
Right, right. So, and I think, you know, that was largely Scott championed that. And I'm, you know, and I know there was other people at Dark Horse that really used that as a strategy. And it was super smart. I didn't even realize at the time how smart it was.
Yeah.
And it was actually the hardest Umbrella Academy story to write. Because I knew I couldn't tell anything about the series.
Right.
I had to show these characters, but I had to show them 10 years before the series started. And it was difficult, to say the least. It took me longer than some of the single issues of the actual series to do.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really dense, and it went through changes, and it went through twists and things like that. And I was walking with Scott in the rain in Portland late at night. Walking around his neighborhood, and I'm like, I don't know, I think I want to start the story with Rumor looking at her own dead body, and that's just how we started.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Go from there. And so
you got to keep, like, I imagine you got to keep a notebook or something, and the minute you see some quirky thing or whatever, and you got to be, okay, that's got to be in my book.
Yeah, I keep, like, several notebooks on me at all times. I have one notebook that's basically my notebook for the series, and I do all issue breakdowns, dialogue snippets, everything, sometimes layouts. I do it all in one notebook, and then I have extra notebooks just in case I'm out somewhere and I see, have an idea for the overall picture. I have lots of notebooks.
Awesome. All right, now I know people are going to want to know, and I don't know if this is in your schedule, but are you ever going to be able to even make a convention, or would that just be – you told a funny story where you said you were on a subway and all of a sudden all these school kids came in and sort of freaked you out. And I'm wondering, you know, would you be able to handle something like that if you just see this? You have to be used to it, I guess. Just lines of people. They're going to want to come see you.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm more comfortable and at home at a comic convention.
Oh, cool.
You know? And again, to see, like, maybe, you know, our, as a band, fan base at a comic convention just makes me feel really good.
Yeah.
That they're actually at a comic convention supporting that medium. Because of my job, and a lot of people would be like, oh, well, that means your schedule's tight and you can't do these things. It actually makes it easier. Like, tomorrow I'm doing a signing at Forbidden Planet London because I just happen to be over here.
Cool.
And so I have a lot more opportunities than, let's say, somebody that's, like, you know, just stuck in the middle of nowhere and they can't really fly out a lot. I'm already in these countries.
Right.
So, like, I can do one in Japan if we go there soon, and things like South America. I can do them in different countries, even countries that don't necessarily have the Umbrella Academy yet. I can do these things and talk about the book and meet the fans of the book. And so that's actually great. I made San Diego 2 years in a row, so that was good.
Cool.
And I would love to do as many conventions as I can. I'd love to do as many signings. We did 2 East Coast signings when the book came out. I plan to do 2 West Coast ones when the trade comes out, one in L.A., one in Portland. And
awesome.
Then, you know, there's lots of really cool cons I want to hit, like in Texas and all over.
Now, you're an artist. I mean, I've seen your work. And how do you feel about that? I mean, obviously, you just said great. Gabriel Baugh is just an awesome guy. But are there any ever, like, notes, or you see something and you go, that quite wasn't what I thought? Like, how's that collaboration working?
It works actually perfectly. And, you know, the craziest thing about Gabriel is, in a lot of ways, he understood the world right away, because I think it already fit into his personal aesthetic.
Oh, yeah. He's a madman. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Like, you know, if you see a lot of his other work, he's, like, already drawing these really crazy robots. He's already drawing, but they're not, like, robots that you would see in a superhero comic at all.
And, right.
He's already drawing these European cars, and he has a sense of European art to his art. And I think that's because of where he's from in a lot of ways. And so he was perfect. And there's really some times where I just say, this is a diner. Like, an issue, I'm just getting pages now from issue 5, and there's a diner, and it's perfect. And, you know, the cars, the cop cars outside the diner are perfect. Like, I didn't have to describe those, you know. And it's, you know, he does it a million times better than I ever could. And that's the best thing you could hope for with an artist.
Right. Now, do you have a lot of friends that read this and go, okay, you obviously wrote this character to be me, and you have to turn around and go, well, no, I didn't.
actually, no, that hasn't really happened yet.
No.
I mean, you know, I'd say a lot of the characters are actually probably a lot inspired by, like, some of the guys in the band, people that I've met on the road, But I haven't had anybody kind of come up yet and say, like, oh, that's me. I mean, I've had friends say really interesting things and been like, oh, I have to. I have a really great friend, John Rivera, who does this comic, Heartbreak. And he maintains the Umbrella Academy MySpace page, and he's definitely like a big help to me. And a lot of times I'll run by issues to him and bounce ideas off him. And I mean, he is such an amazing, like half the stuff that comes out of his mouth as a human being, you know, it's so amazing that it's definitely ended up being said by some of the characters.
That's cool. Now, you say you're touring around and you're talking about European styles. What's been the response outside of the U.S. to either, I know you said some people haven't seen Umbrella Academy yet, but just comics in general, it just seems like they are a little more friendly than our own mass public.
They are, and there is, especially traveling around, for example, like, I can't remember where I was. I think I was in Brussels, and comic shops were amazing.
Wow.
Like, multi-leveled, original artwork hanging on the walls. Walls of hardcover editions of European trades, and just phenomenal. Like it's filled with like adults, you know.
Right.
They'll take their comics very seriously in Europe, and the response in the UK has been really huge. The Umbrella Academy. There's been, I know, a lot of requests for it in some parts of Europe and South America as well, and a little bit in Japan. So. We are going to bring Umbrella Academy to Europe for sure.
Is there a part of you that sort of feels the need to say, even to whatever audience you're talking to at that time, to sort of be like, hey, you know what? This is me. The comics are, you know, they're cool. You know, I mean, do you ever feel
right.
the need that this is what you need to present?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, yeah, in a lot of ways to represent it as something that's actually like very cool, very smart. Very creative. I mean, like, comics are really capable of anything. In a lot of ways, they're capable of things that movies aren't.
Right.
And they've always been that way. Like, you know, example Scott always uses is The Watchmen. Now, I think that movie's going to be great, but there are definitely things in that comic that only work because it's a comic.
Right.
And as a writer, you have to learn the strengths of an actual comic, which is what I spent a lot of time and still trying to learn those things. I'm still taking the approach a little bit as a movie, but there's things that I can't do that way.
Yeah.
You know, I have to rely on the strength of the comic. So, yeah, I mean, like, I feel it's my responsibility in some ways to just, you know, let the kids know. It's like, no, comics are actually really cool and really fun. The thing is about the generation right now, the youth culture, they actually already feel that way. They all read manga.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Which I find to be really interesting because I don't read manga. I read, like the classics, like Otomo and Akira, but very unfamiliar with modern manga, and they all read it already.
Hmm. So they're used to the storytelling. That just it's probably the content more than anything that's keeping
right.
them away. Yeah,
they're definitely not used to the content of like something like the Umbrella Academy is totally new to them.
Right. So you think Watchmen's going to be great, huh?
I really do because I really like the director.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, I'm a huge Dawn of the Dead fan, right? Huge. I watch it every Christmas with my brother. That's like our Christmas movie.
That's so awesome.
Went to the theater as, you know, me and the band, we all went and saw it. Not expecting anything. Didn't, you know, weren't skeptical. I never sit down a movie skeptical.
Right.
You know?
You're setting yourself
up. The theater.
Yeah, you're setting yourself up for failure if you do that. Yeah,
yeah, totally. So I'm just sat down, like, let's see what this dude does. And we had one of the best frigging times ever watching that movie. And it was a theater with noisy, loud people, like, having a great time. Normally that could detract from a movie, but it really made the movie even more fun. And it was already a great film. You know, that opening 10 minutes
yeah.
is, like, so amazing. And so I liked Zach back then. I loved the song he used at the end of that film. You know, even stuff, like, little choices like that, like using a punk song and ending that movie with that. And then I love 300
mm-hmm.
and I thought, you know, I love the comic, but in a lot of ways I thought it was great to see it as a film because of the acting that was able to come across.
Right.
Which you necessarily couldn't get in the comic.
And he wasn't afraid to put a style to it. This was not just some rehash of history. There was a definite style to it that I thought
oh, yeah.
a lot of people sort of, especially a lot of critics didn't quite get.
Right, right. He wasn't afraid to say, well, this is how my Spartans look.
Right.
You know? This is the way I see it looking, or Frank Miller saw it, you know, and he was not afraid of that at all. And for that reason specifically, I think Watchmen is going to be amazing. It's going to be, I mean, he's already started to pick, I mean, from the cast I know, Rorschach's perfect, especially having seen the film Little Children,
mm-hmm.
And seeing two of those actors in that film. And then, you know the color palette's going to be dead on.
Right, right.
And you know a lot of things. You know he's not changing the era. So I have high hopes for it.
You're an aspiring screenwriter as well, I read somewhere. So what are your hopes for Umbrella Academy? Or is it too early for that?
I think it's too early. I love film. I think screenwriting is probably one of the most difficult arts. I think it's harder than writing a comic. For simply pacing, it's probably a lot more dense and tougher. The beauty of the first series is that, you know, me and Scott had talked about this. You could literally hand that over to a screenwriter and say, just follow this. It has a beginning, middle, and end. All the characters change. You know, it tells you who they are without boring you. It doesn't spend half a movie explaining their origins. It doesn't waste any time with that. It just throws you into it, and yet you're learning information at the same time. It's really concise. So you could hand that over to a screenwriter, and me and Scott feel really confident that we wouldn't even really have to lean over their shoulder.
Right.
And it would be really cool. I'd like to get a few more series into it and get a perspective on it to see. And it would also have to be done very much not like a blockbuster film, and that's the risk you run when, you know, they take your film. They want it to be a huge summer movie, probably, especially if it's superheroes, especially if it's action.
Yeah.
This is the kind of film that, you know, I'd see more easily being directed by the director that did Harry Potter 3, for example.
Hmm.
You know, who has a completely different way of making a film like that. And I think 3 is the best of all the Harry Potter films because of the way it's directed.
Right.
And, I don't know how critics or kids felt about that one, but... you need somebody like that that's going to, you know, it's the same guy that did Children of Men. Like it.
Right, right.
It needs that kind of realism in that fantasy-driven world and that oddness to it. You know?
That was interesting what you said about origin stories, too. Because you spent in Umbrella Academy, you spent maybe, three, four, five pages, and then boom, the whole first tale, but then we're at a point where it's years later and we're almost relearning who these characters are and where they've been. That's an interesting story device.
Well, the way I saw it, especially with the beginning of the comic, is you're reading a comic. Like, if you're reading a comic in the first place, you're most likely familiar with Spider-Man. You're familiar, at least, just from the films. You're already in this playground, in a way. I'm not reinventing the wheel. I'm trying to tell a great story in a new way.
Sure.
I'm trying to, you know, look up to my idols like Grant and really tread new ground. But it is in a familiar setting. So it's like, why do I need to spend all these issues explaining? I'll do it in 3 panels.
Right.
You know? They're
right.
Special. They were born in a weird way. They got adopted. They wear masks. Like, you know, you already know where we are. Why did I have to explain it to you? So I don't. And I just throw you into it and... To me, it's like the opening of that series was the most important part of it.
Hmm. And what are you learning as you go on issue to issue, how much you're able to pull back with maybe some of your scripts or how much you're able to let the art tell the story? Because, you know, there's hardly any narration. And in fact, if there is narration, it's usually what's the one? There was some comment about whatever the city, a very nice morning. You know what kind?
Right.
You don't ever get descriptions like that. You know,
right?
But yet it sets it's definitely sets up a mood.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, you know you're reading something different right away when you see things like that. And yeah, there is no narration. The only narration is the very beginning, and that's all I felt you needed. Really, it's just these little vignettes in a lot of ways. These little brief scenes. They're all going to kind of come together at the end. I'm a big fan of, P.T. Anderson in a lot of ways and Wes Anderson.
Hmm.
And there's a certain storytelling in that where it's just, like, short, often quiet scenes that all just end up together in the same place. But I am finding that I'm learning more and letting the art tell, you know, definitely a lot. And that's the thing I forgot about often in the beginning, and I would almost overwrite it. Yeah. And then Scott would be like, no, you could just have Gabrielle show this.
Right.
And I guess it was more about developing that trust with him.
Cool. Well, what would you want your readers to walk away from? Or maybe how would you sell this to someone who maybe is not a fan of quirkiness, or not to say that that's what this book is, but, you know,
right.
there's a lot of Grant Morrison detractors out there and who think that this type of writing is, just to say how cool I am. But I don't see that in this, and I obviously don't see it in Morrison's work either. There's something about ideas and my God, if you remember the Silver Age, they were crazy back then.
Totally hit it right there. It's about ideas.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I would say to somebody like that, that's what comics are about. Like Stanley and Jack Kirby sitting at 3 a.m, chain smoking, dreaming up a fucking Silver Surfer. Like, are you kidding me? That's comics. Like, I would say to any of those people, what you're reading isn't comics.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. You know, like, what is comics like fucking melodrama?
Yeah.
And dudes in other tights beating up other dudes, like, constantly, and how shocking it is that iconic hero A is beating on iconic hero B, like, to fucking death. Like, I'm over it. You know, like, that's not comics to me.
Right.
At all. You know, like, comics are just comics, all they are is ideas. Crazy, batshit ideas. And that, to me, like, when people talk about Grant, it's like, Grant loves superheroes more than any of the other top guys. Like, when he's writing a superhero story, he loves them.
Right.
Like, he's not trying to deconstruct them. He's not spoofing them. He's not making fun of them. The Superman issue I read that he wrote about him and his father, like, literally made me cry.
Yeah.
I don't remember the last time a comic or a film did that, you know?
Yeah.
He was able to nail that character so well and boil him down to what he really was. You know, again, another story that no origin, didn't need it,
right?
You know, but that's what I would say to, like, people that are skeptical of ideas and quirkiness. It's like, that's really what comics are. They're, you know, Jack Kirby going absolutely nuts at 4 a.m. trying to meet a deadline and dreaming up an insane world, like drawing a map of Asgard.
Right. God, those first 50 issues of Fantastic Four alone, you know,
right.
They created the Marvel Universe in 50 issues and then ended it with a big purple guy with spikes on his head. I mean, it just, and a big G on his chest.
Right.
I mean, those were so crazy and out there.
They always went big. I mean, yeah, and like, yeah, dude shows up to eat the world, man. Like, you don't get bigger than that.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I had, like, 10-year-olds fighting the Eiffel Tower. Like, how do you get bigger than that? You know? Wasn't
yeah.
the longest fight in the world. Didn't really need to be. Honestly, it wasn't the longest fight because, like, how the hell do you fight an Eiffel Tower?
And plus, it was a great introduction because right away I was skeeved out about it. You know, I was like, ooh, these kids right. are powerful and they're talking like adults and they're here to save the
right.
day. That's kind of creepy.
Yeah. Definitely, like, a little bit Village of the Damned prisoner vibe going on.
Exactly.
So.
Well, great. This has been really enjoyable, and hopefully we can get...
Yeah, for me too.
Great. I hope we can get some new readers out there who weren't so sure about the book, now that they know, you know, that this is not just a vanity project. This is something that you really, really are looking to do the long haul with.
Right. Completely.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you so much, and definitely enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks a lot, man.
You bet.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, so that was Gerard Way, the writer of Umbrella Academy from Dark Horse, and, you know, that was awesome that he was able to give us his time. And but I'm not done talking about Umbrella Academy, and on the phone is Dr. Jeff Klock again. How are you, man?
Hey, I'm good. I like the sound. Dr. Jeff Klock. It has a good... I don't get to hear it that often, and it's a very good... Some of my students call me Doc Klock, which I like quite a bit.
That's great.
They do it accidentally. I don't even think they're aware of the kind of super villainy sound of that.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Maybe they are, and I'm not giving them enough credit. But yes, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me on.
What's kind of funny is, you know, when we correspond down below your name, it's Dr. Phil or Dr. of Phil or something. It doesn't quite... put it all out, so it makes me think of Dr. Phil himself. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's because I have a doctorate, and so I get to be called doctor, but it's in England, they don't call it a PhD. In America, it's called a PhD. philosophical doctorate, PhD.
Right.
But in England, they call it a DPhil for some reason. So it's a doctor of philosophy. And the slightly different thing of it, I can't technically put PhD after my name. I have to write DPhil.
Uh-huh.
So that's why it says that at the bottom of it. That's, you know, across the pond, they do things. So there you go.
Yeah. So Umbrella Academy, you talked a little bit about it before, and I thought, you know what, let's get a little bit deeper into this. For people who don't know what the exact story is, it's a scientist notices that there's like these 40-some kids that were all born at the same exact moment because of some weird event, and he manages to find 7 of them and raise them in this raise them to be, for lack of a better term, superheroes because of some threat that is coming to Earth in the near future. And we follow one exploit of them as kids fighting the Eiffel Tower, which is just awesome. And I should say spoilers, I guess, because we'll probably get a little deep into this maybe.
This is, to be fair, a book where, I mean, this isn't Lost.
Right.
A lot of the joy in this is a kind of, you know, there's a lot of fun stuff on every page so that the plot becomes, the sort of suspense aspect of the plot becomes less important than kind of, it's less important than it would be on other books because it's, I don't know how to, I mean that as a compliment.
Oh, no, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
Having trouble expressing that thought there.
And then we get to a point where we jump ahead out of the origin story into you know, almost 10, 20 years later. And they've disbanded, and they are a family, so there's little disruptions and feuds and things and competitions. And, you know, some family members have gone off and come back, and one of them is dead, and we don't know why. So we're smack in the middle of this family reforming and forming, and there's all these subplots that there's these other agents that are going to battle them now that they've reformed, and we always have that looming threat of whatever they were brought together in the first place for in the background. But beyond all that, it is just chock full of, number one, gorgeous art, number two, incredible ideas that are fun and silly and just, you know, like, there's a guy, like you said before, there's a guy walking around with a human head and a monkey's body, and there's no explanation. There's one panel that sort of explains that he may have been in an accident and his father, you know, put him on. They don't even mention a monkey's body. They just say a surgery.
Yeah.
And that's all
there's actually a funny bit because the it's going across sort of newspapers on the wall, and the first picture is of the kid in a spacesuit with a monkey in a spacesuit.
Right.
Because, of course, shooting monkeys into space. And then the second panel, you know, he's injured in experimental surgery. I think you're supposed to presume that he killed the kid's pet and put him on the – right? That he grew up? I guess monkeys and gorillas aren't the same things. So I shouldn't say that. But, right, it seems like there's some kind of – there's a reason why the kid has a sort of pet monkey astronaut, and then in the next panel – he's been attached to a giant gorilla body.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was the body that they used, or if that was Pogo, the guy that he talks to.
Oh, that's
later.
Right. Of course, that's right. I forget. There's another sort of monkey character in here.
Right. There's so many monkeys. So if you like monkeys,
it's chock full of monkeys, and that's why you should buy it.
It is. It's just a fun book that is, you know, it's, you don't have to get so immersed in other things, you know. You just know good and evil, and everybody has a family, so they can certainly relate to at least one of these characters, whether it's, you know, Kraken, who is sort of like the Wolverine analogy in this family, and because actually Gerard Way did mention that, you know, this was sort of, not in these words, but that this was his X-Men, sort of, you know, that they were a family, and now that's sort of what he used for this book. You know, you have the loner, the one who we have no idea if she has any powers at all, who has gone off for years and wrote an expose on her father, so she's like the outcast. And another one who sort of was in the public eye and is now in a divorce, she's divorcing her husband. She has a daughter she probably doesn't see. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
And one thing I would consider is if you're at all interested in reading the book, Dark Horse on MySpace. MySpace has a Dark Horse Presents has a MySpace page. Look, yep. I got that sentence out. and if you go there, I believe they at one point recently, and probably still do, have archived a kind of preview issue of it, a kind of 8-page story, again, by Wei and Ba. So if you want to check it out without sort of paying any money, Dark Horse, that Dark Horse Presents page on MySpace, I think is absolutely brilliant, because it worked on me. I mean, really, reading some of that stuff has suckered me into sort of buying more Dark Horse projects, which is exactly what they wanted to do. But, you know, free comic books by people like Joss Whedon, Fabio Moon, Gabriel Ba, you got to jump right in on that.
Oh, yeah. Now, one of the, I just thought of this now. One of the questions I just didn't even think to ask him, you know, the Umbrella Academy, what the hell is that about? You know, what's that title about? So do you have any thoughts on that?
Umbrellas, there's something great about Umbrellas, actually. There's this moment, I mean, and again, not a good movie, but in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the movie, there's a moment early on when they come out of one guy, again, I haven't seen this movie in a long time. He comes out of they come out of a building, and the guy's got an umbrella, and it's like a newfangled invention or something, and it looks sort of, there's something faintly absurd. I think one of the older characters makes a comment about what a weird thing this is,
right.
And then he sort of puts it up his head, above his head, and he's protected from the rain. It's such a kind of great, there's something about an umbrella that's a very kind of like, I don't know, like it's a new piece of technology. Do you know what I mean? It's there to protect you from the rain, but it's also somewhat absurd looking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these great sort of, you know, it's one of these wonderful sort of symbolic objects that always pops up in sort of Freudian dream analysis, loves to see the umbrella. It's one of those great sort of dream symbols that people can pounce all over. But I mean, and it has that idea of like protection. It protects you from things. So it certainly makes sense, you know, in the world of superheroes that are here. They're like the umbrella protecting Earth from whatever will fall from the sky, like aliens or whatever. But it's also a kind of old-fashioned, but right, umbrella is one of these things that hasn't really changed that much
right.
since, you know, when it was invented. There's something kind of basic about it. And so it does, there's something kind of odd, there's something kind of also old-fashioned feeling about it. It feels very sort of, it's such a dramatic thing, too, with the rain and, you know, Victorian England and the umbrellas it is strengthened by the use of the word academy, which makes you think of kind of with the prep school uniforms as well.
Right.
Makes you think of this sort of prep school, rainy English prep school thing, but also the idea of the umbrella kind of protects. I think it's a great title.
Yeah, and that's actually how we first see them as little kids, is
right.
all dressed up in the same same uniforms with masks. And when we get to see them when they're older, when Space Boy actually goes back to the home, we see all those umbrellas on the floor just like broken
right.
and battered and tattered. And so, yeah, it definitely makes a sense on just on that kind of level. Yeah. So what else about the book? What do you get more into? I mean, when I was talking to Gerard, I mentioned about the family thing. There's such strong family themes going on. You know, the father and how he addresses the kids and what they think of him. And then there's this mother who is, you know, what the hell is she? You know, is she a robot? She has no arms. You see her organs. It's just crazy.
It does. I mean, it's the X-Men comparison, I think, is apt. It's an X-Men book, you know, that you kind of imagine. I shouldn't probably bring up the Venture Brothers again, but I can't help. There's a vague Venture Brothers connection that I'm thinking of here, which is the Venture Brothers sort of pictures what Johnny Quest would look like a generation later, in which everything is kind of degenerated. And in the Venture Brothers, it's really played for big laughs. So the degeneration in the degeneration in the next generation, what a ridiculously bad sentence that is. Is absurd, you know, the characters they're all grotesque, right? Instead of sort of being healthy people now, it's like skinny scientists and, you know, gigantic hulking brutes and, you know, nobody sort of, the balance is off. And in the same way here, Umbrella Academy feels very much like, it has a kind of X-Men feel, sort of if the X-Men were allowed to sort of, you know, get sad and lonely and kind of not really be a family anymore and be distant and be awkward and distant around each other. I mean, obviously there's some amount of angst in X-Men comic books, but this is a particularly kind of, you know, Victorian boarding school awkward thing where nobody, you know, people wanted to be superheroes and now they sort of are, but are not, it's not quite as happy as they thought it would be.
Right.
And it definitely, it makes me think of the Venture Brothers a little bit, just in terms of sort of frustrated dreams of superheroes. And of course the whole idea of the sort of family freak show that's sort of lorded over by this, you know, aloof father figure like Xavier.
Right. Well, actually, he even referenced the Doom Patrol as well. I mean,
yeah.
You know, look at that family, that guy in a wheelchair, a robot, a hermaphrodite, negative woman, man, hermaphrodite.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is sort of like a mixture of Doom Patrol and X-Men. And
It should be because, I mean, I believe, and I don't know if I could be getting my comic book history wrong here, but I believe that Doom Patrol was DC's answer to the X-Men.
Yeah, they both were sort of created around the same time, and there's always been an answer or always been a question of, which one was informed by the other. I mean, they came out literally months apart,
right?
Or maybe more, you know, half a year or more, maybe. Come on, two guys in a wheelchair and a bunch of freaks around them. Now, obviously, the mutant thing was stronger than the freak aspect.
Right.
So,
well, it was more franchisable, is what it was. With the idea of mutant powers, it was more you were going to be able to sort of generate lots and lots of these characters as a result of the mutant X gene, and you could spawn it into 34 spin-off books, whereas Doom Patrol was never really designed to hold that kind of large picture.
And what's sort of interesting about the Umbrella, the characters in this too, is, yeah, they have, you know, some of them have real world problems, divorces, whatever, but they're never played as characters that, you know, have feet of clay, as some superhero books, you know, they get so morose and just, you know, people just at the end of the day, probably they don't mind that stuff as long as you give them Superman versus Brainiac, you know, or something, or Doomsday or something like that. And this one has all that stuff that could get bogged down, and yet it doesn't. It stays light. It stays fun. And damn, that art and that coloring just helps to move the story along.
Well, importantly, the angsty elements that you're talking about are, I think a lot of books often take those, a lot of sort of, you know, superhero twisty books take that as plot points, the divorces and the unpleasantness of sort of life like that. And here, they're not plot points, they're character points. You get gestures toward what these characters' lives are like, but the book also has an adventure, crazy plot that keeps those character elements from getting too overwhelming. So it doesn't become, for example, a character study of a superhero going through a divorce, as I can imagine in a kind of, you know, Astro City kind of way.
That's a good point. Character plot versus or what did you say? Character point versus a plot point.
It's the angsty stuff you're talking about. They're character points rather than plot points.
So which one of these characters do you sort of get attracted to the most?
Well, I mean, you know, Space Boy's got it. He's in a monkey body and he's an astronaut. I mean, how can that not be here? But I mean, I suppose everybody has their own thing. They're all great. They're really funny. They're really well. Again, one of the things he's clearly thought through the backgrounds of these characters quite well, and it makes them all seem kind of distinct and with their own individual histories. They're very sort of memorable and interesting and funny. I mean, and it's simple stuff too. He's a very good writer in terms of doing things like, you know, introducing I remember the characters, but I tend not to remember their names very well. Where the guy shows up and he says, "You know what I love about funerals? Everything I own is black." I mean, I know immediately I get this character. Like, he's very, you know what I mean? He's sardonic and funny, and I you know, I get a kick out of him instantly.
His name is Seance.
That's right.
Which already brings so much to it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of sort of great elements in it, and the characters are, they all have these sort of interesting backgrounds, and he's thought through it. You can tell there's a level of depth there where he only has to sort of gesture one little, divorce or whatever, or, I didn't even know you had a daughter, and you can feel this much larger family relationship without having to spend page after page after page on them.
Yeah, and I think he does, to go back to the names, Space Boy, Kraken, you know, Rumor, they're already, you can sort of just tell who they are just by their names alone.
Yeah. When you're designing a television show, I'm sure it's the same way for comic book, is you want to have like a show Bible. And one of the things that goes in the show Bible is detailed biographies of all your characters. Even though the details of those biographies might not come into the show for years and years and years, you want to think them through ahead of time so your whole thing sort of remains consistent. And I think this book suggests that there is a kind of detailed Umbrella Academy Bible somewhere that has really interesting, detailed, fascinating character histories in them.
In the second issue, we were introduced to the conductor and his orchestra. The orchestra, I'm going to get the next word wrong, Verdammten?
Yeah, I don't know. I know. My German's not, you know, so hot.
Where he's creating this, what he's calling the Apocalypse Suite.
Right.
I thought that was sort of, you know, here's a musician writing a comic about music.
Right.
And I thought that was sort of interesting that he's, I assume, possibly bringing in his experience as a musician into this.
And there's also a little a cute little thing when those characters are introduced. It's something that Fabio Moon or Matt Fraction pointed out in the back of the most recent Casanova issue, which is that, of course, Gabriel Ba used to draw Casanova, and now he draws, you know, now he draws Umbrella Academy, and that Fabio Moon, his twin brother, if rumors would be believed, draws Casanova. And that there was this moment, this very similar moment, the shot of sort of the evil villain in the cape, in the background of all of his minions are sort of behind him with the masks on, is exactly the same as the last page of Casanova. I think it's 10, in which you have the sort of evil doctor guy in the movie theater with all of his the evil therapist guy with in the movie theater with all of his minions, similarly in well dressed with masks on, and it's cute because it's like the same artist drawing. It's artists, brother artists. You know, one used to draw Casanova, now the Casanova image chimes with the Umbrella Academy image. It's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. I mean, there's definitely a lot. What else about this would you like to bring up? Anything else?
Well, I tell you, I was looking at, I don't know much about Gerard Way, and so I went and looked a little stuff up on the internet, and I don't know. Who knows? You know, it's the internet. Who knows if it could be true? But if the Wikipedia is to be believed, Gerard Way started his first sort of experience sort of singing on the stage was playing Peter Pan in the fourth grade.
Huh.
That strikes me as phenomenally interesting in thinking about Umbrella Academy because, of course, Peter Pan is this story about a kid who gets to forever be a kid. Right? He gets to, the child stays a child forever, and that these other children are sort of, you know, introduced to this world where they can be children forever, but then maybe there's something that's not good about that. Maybe growing up is important. Maybe there's an adult world they need to be a part of. Maybe there's something weirdly dead about being in perpetual childhood all the time. And so Peter Pan is about sort of the tensions between being a child and being an adult and that. And it comes up interestingly here because, of course, one of the things, Gerard Way, My Chemical Romance, of course, all these sort of teenage rock songs are very much, and one of his most famous songs is called Teenagers. And he has songs about, he mentions his dad in one of the most famous songs on Black Parade. And he mentions that there's a song sort of, you know, addressed to sort of mama. And this sort of adult kid stuff that runs through, because the one where he mentions his dad, he talks about his dad taking him to, you know, telling him this story, son, the Black Parade. He takes him to a marching band. And again, there, when the music, you can see there's this tension between being an adult and being in a kid, which is what all about sort of that teenage angsty music is about. And then at the same time, it pops up in the comic. This is what the comic is about. Mm-hmm. And it provides a sort of wonderful, you know, just in the same way it kind of invigorates sort of rock to talk about that transition from adulthood to from childhood to adulthood. It's the same thing here. The little kids that are sort of, they're like morose and serious little children. They look like little children, but they act like adults. And then they grow up to be, you know, what children want to become, which is superheroes. But then that adult world isn't as sort of fun and free as little kids would imagine it to be. It's grumpier than you would think. And again, tension between adults and kids. And then there's a bigger, just to mention one more bigger, and this is possibly too big.
well, wait, before you...
Gerard Way said that one of the big things behind his creation of My Chemical Romance was September 11th attacks.
Yeah.
That was sort of one of the big things. And, of course, what is the very first story in Umbrella Academy he's transposed the attack to another major national landmark. It's not the Twin Towers being attacked and blown up, but it's the Eiffel Tower. And for a lot of people, one of the big things that sort of issues that came up around September 11th was this idea that America has been living for so long in a kind of perpetual dreamland childhood, and now they need to wake up and realize that the world is really like this, and they've ignored the countries outside their borders for too long, and there's a kind of like global adulthood theme going on with 9/11, you know, because sort of people were saying that America was a kind of child that had now grown up, and September 11th was the thing that would cause America to sort of be, you know, now you see what living in Israel is like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, I think, just to see that theme of adulthood versus childhood going through. Oh, and I should say one more thing to say, of course, is that comics is such a wonderful place to talk about adulthood versus childhood issues because comic books themselves experience this massive demographic shift where they used to be read by children of all ages, or children of both genders, and now have become primarily the target audience for comic books is 18 to 24-year-old college-educated males.
Mm-hmm.
And with interestingly, the stories that are being told are their adult stories using the building blocks from children's literature. You know, the Superman was conceived of as a child's character, but now we tell very kind of advanced sort of stories with him and characters like him. So I just think it's interesting to see that adulthood versus childhood theme that pops up in Peter Pan and My Chemical Romance and Umbrella Academy and this larger sort of 9/11 picture.
Hmm. Not to mention number five himself, the kid who comes back from the future with a 60-year-old mentality trapped in a 10-year-old body.
Right.
Certainly speaks to what you were talking about.
Yeah, it's interesting, and in fact, the preview issue, not the preview issue, the Free Comic Book Day issue.
Mm-hmm.
The title of that issue was called I think it was called "The Past Ain't Through with You." I believe, yeah, it was called "The Past Ain't Through with You." I think there, I think that quote again, Wikipedia. Thank you for that. You know, I shouldn't. I have students. I tell not to use Wikipedia, and then as soon as I come home from class, I come home and looking up on Wikipedia. Wikipedia. Tells me that the line that Gerard Way uses for that title, "The Past Ain't Through With You," is from one of his songs. I mean, he's quoting his own song there, which is "Kill All Your Friends." And I think, again, interesting, he likes Morrison, and he's friends with Morrison. It's a very Morrison thing to do, to, like, quote your own stuff. Again, think about Morrison using, like, Solaris in
right.
All-Star Superman, right? You canonizing his own work by sort of having it show up again. And it is a long line of using your own stuff. Emerson used to put his own poems at the front of his essays as kind of introductions. But the film Magnolia has a line, "We might be through with the past, but the past ain't through with us." And again, for that to be the title of the comic book, the Free Comic Book Day issue, to come from this second half of that, from Magnolia to the song by My Chemical Romance, to the title of the Umbrella Academy Free Comic Book Day issue. Again, it's this childhood versus adulthood, right? You think you're done with this, but maybe you're not. Maybe this weird sort of tension between childhood and adulthood. I think it's a really interesting theme that sort of grounds all the craziness. Really, there's some serious things going on there, and it's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, what's sort of funny is he talked about a big fan of being a big fan of Dark Horse and Hellboy, and you know, there's a character Hellboy. He's called
yeah.
Hell, you know, but he's not a boy. So there's,
right.
you know, yeah, so I can see, and I remember when we talked earlier about this book where I said I got a very strong Hellboy vibe off of this, but,
yeah.
So he's clearly influenced by a lot, but it does come out highly original and creative.
It is. It's one of these things that draws on a number of different sources, and it does feel surprisingly fresh. Although I will say, for people reading it, I thought the first issue, I liked it. But I wasn't sort of crazy about it, and it wasn't until that it really kicked in with the second issue with me. Spending more time with the adult characters was the thing that really sort of sold me on the book more than the first issue with the little kids was good. Although I feel like if I had known them as adults first, I would have sort of had more sympathy with the little kid characters rather than going in chronological order. But the second issue really kicks into gear, and then you go back and you sort of realize. You get more out of the first issue when you read the second one because you sort of see who these characters grew up to be, and it's a good story. It's got a lot of really fun stuff in here.
Yeah, yeah, and definitely it's one of those stories that from page one of number one, you know, it's something that's going to be different. I mean, there's a wrestler fighting a squid or whatever the hell he's fighting.
Yeah, it's
you
a
know.
Crazy alien octopusy thing.
Yeah, so it's. I think that's part of the reason why, you know, when you do first see just the kids come, you know this world is skewed to begin with.
Yeah.
So it's a great setup. But I agree. I think, and he sort of referenced that too about not wanting to belabor too much on origin stories and rather just get into where the true story is, as you said, is when they're adults.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Well, Jeff, it's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being, you know, brought in. It's you know, it's nice to be here.
Great.
As my little nephew says from watching too much of Pixar's Cars, he says, "Nice working with you." Nice working with you. He says, "I didn't even think he knows what it means." Nice working with you.
Nice working.
He's little. He's like a little. He's like four. Nice working with you.
Awesome. Hey, we're talking about kids, and you know, these kids nowadays, they know they're you can't shortchange what a child knows nowadays.
That's true.
It's amazing what comes out of their mouth. Well, awesome. Well, I will say my goodbye so I can wrap up the rest of the show, and we will, as always, be in touch. And look forward to hearing reading your blog, jeffclock.com.
Oh no, it's a Jeff GEO. It's jeffclock.blogspot.com is where
okay.
I'm sending people. GEOFFKLOCK.blogspot.com.
Awesome, great. Well, you have a good rest of the day.
All right, thank you.
See you, man.
Bye.
Bye. And as I said, that's going to wrap up this episode. So thank you both to Jeff Clock and, of course, to Gerard Way. And especially another thank you to Dark Horse Comics for allowing us, you know, getting that interview. Great. So we will see you in the new week. Take care.